and Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. Thank you all for joining us today. Representative Hack is here with us as well. I understand we have overflow in Hearing Room D. So I wanted to start out with a couple of comments about how we're going to run the hearing. I know for some people, it's the first time that you've had the opportunity to come to the legislature. So some of you might have handouts with you. When you come to do your handouts, we'll call people up one at a time, and you can give the handouts to Maria, and then Maria will pass them out to all of us. I do need you to check any handouts and materials that you have that you are turning in to make sure that it doesn't have any personally identifying information about your clients on it. Most of what has been submitted to us and put into OLIS, we have to find a way to take down because there were a large number of HIPAA violations, a lot of personally identifiable information about clients, and that's really problematic. That's the other request. If you are speaking, it's great if you're a provider to speak about your experience and the work that you need to do. We need to ask you not to speak about specific clients unless your clients are here and given you permission to do that. The other request is to be certain, and this again was concerning in some of the materials that were shared today, that the way in which we talk about the clients that I know we all care about really needs to be respectful of the dignity and humanity of the individuals who are served in adult foster homes. Some of the information that came today into OLIS was deeply concerning and has been turned over to licensing, and I was required, my mandatory abuse reporter responsibility was triggered by some of that information. So again, the issue of provider rates is very important, but I would ask that people be thoughtful when you're speaking, and again, clients should only speak for themselves. Only clients can tell their own stories. Certainly tell the story about the work that you do, but personal information about clients, I'll have to ask you to stop if we go into that area. So do we have a second sheet?
We do, Madam Chair.
Yeah, let's get the second sheet.
Looks like that gentleman maybe wants to sign.
And we can put up another piece. And then the last thing that you should be aware of too is that if you haven't been here before, everything is being recorded, so it's on video. So it's being people that are at home. There are people that watch on the internet. You can also pull the recording of the hearing down later, so you can rewatch it. But just also keep in mind, anything that you're saying here becomes part of a permanent record, and anybody can pull down that video and audio tape. Sometimes people are a little bit surprised by that. And then the last thing is, because there's all that recording equipment, cell phones really interfere with that recording and make it difficult for people to hear that are watching right now through the internet. I know this is an issue about which there's a great deal of interest. So if you have a cell phone with you, if you can turn it all the way off, not just to vibrate, but all the way off, because if it rings, vibrates, you get a text, it interferes with that recording signal. And then we have with us a special guest today, Representative Jody Hack, and she is joining us here because she represents many of you. And with that, the order that we're going in today, we're going to start with any clients that want to speak. We'll then go into providers, the county, the state. So I can't tell who people are based on the list. Are there any clients? Are there any individuals? Great. So why don't the two of you come?
Three.
Okay, great. Come on up. Clients that want to speak. So that wasn't just, are there clients in the room? Clients that wish to speak. Yes, right there. And you don't have to get the microphone too close to you, and you can sit in any chair that you find comfortable. And you get to be the guinea pig as being the first person. So start with your name, and that's all there is to it.
Something here that I'd like to read.
Perfect. And can you pull the microphone just a little closer to you? Thank you.
Okay. My name is Rick Ballard, and I wanted to come here today because I have something to say. I currently reside in an adult foster home. I have a dual diagnosis of bipolar disorder with psychotic features and alcoholism. Prior to foster care, my life was a chaotic mess filled with periods of incarceration, hospitalization, and many suicide attempts. I found it difficult or impossible at times to manage my own life. Between mental illness and alcoholism, my life was anything but a pretty picture. After residing in foster care for 4 months, my mother died. The security and stability afforded by foster care gave me an opportunity to grieve while remaining emotionally stable and sober. I now have 1 year of sobriety, which is the longest period of recovery in my life.
Congratulations.
Thank you. The owners of the foster homes are in the business to make a profit. Foster homes are not a charity business and cannot operate at a loss. I believe wholeheartedly that the cuts to mental health beds would close foster homes. People that live in these homes deserve the opportunity that I have had to receive the care and structure necessary to improve the quality of their lives. Independent living does not provide the safety and structure that are of utmost importance. These variables should not be quantified into a monetary amount. Without foster care, many people that reside in these homes would end up in institutions or homeless. This is the story of my life, as well as the people that I live with. The potential homelessness and needless institutionalization would be an abomination. The cuts made to foster care are bad policy, reckless, and irresponsible.
Thank you very much. And again, congratulations. Thank you. Applause was very well deserved. Unfortunately, another one of the strange rules that we have in the legislature is that we are apparently an anti-applause society. So we can't applaud, but we can do our hands up. But I don't want to gavel anybody down. Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Lisa Javner. I have a confession to make. I'm a paranoid schizophrenic. I don't need adult foster care now, but I would like it available if I do need it in the future. Cutting the payments to foster care will essentially make it impossible for people with my disability to find adequate housing. This will result in mentally ill patients winding up on the street. I know that the mentally ill are low on the totem pole for resources, but why? Are we not also the creation of a good God? God made men in his image and considers all of them valuable. But the cutting of payments to homes says to the mentally ill, you are disposable. We are not responsible for your care. Isn't this what the Nazis did? I'm a citizen of the United States. I vote, I laugh, I cry. I have a mom, sons, a daughter, and a granddaughter. Friends, brothers, and sisters in Christ, I breathe too, and I am not going to let others tell me I am not valuable. God says that I am valuable to him.
Thank you very, very much. And you're getting a lot of applause behind you. You can't hear it, but if you turn around, you can see it. And, sir, did you want to come up and make some comments too?
Yes, I sure did.
Wonderful. Come on up.
Okay.
Make yourself comfortable at whichever chair looks best.
Good afternoon, people. My name is Mr. Scott Carl Johnson, and I'm currently an overall long-time adult foster care and or group home resident as since the year 2001. When I began such residency as at the Jefferson AFCH site on Fisher Road Northeast. However, after being evicted or put out of 7 to 8 different AFHs as I found myself in living in and across all parts of the city of Salem due to my diagnosis of dual
you're doing great.
Dual
diagnosis?
Schizophrenia is more of the point. Anyway, and the last previous care group home I resided at before the one I reside at now was known as Horizon House, which was on Greenway Drive Northeast, or over by the state hospital. And funny enough, I resided in there for a short time in one of the wards, but I enjoyed my stay there very well. I found it quite productive. But anyway, to proceed, after that, after my eviction from there due to my mental health problem, I found myself at the Union Gospel Mission or homeless, and I would have remained in the fall and winter of 2014-2015, and if I hadn't been rescued by the Petries, Mr. and Mrs. Daniel and Terry Petrie, I would still be there. But they gave me a second or third chance to come back with them, which I gratefully appreciate. And I've just, with my various kinds of medications, I take a good handful of different medications morning, noon, and night. I wouldn't be here testifying at all. I'd be a basket case, if you will. And anyway, for the record, the reason I'm here today is to testify wholeheartedly against this proposed new system as done by SEIU and or the Oregon Health Authority. I did my homework, read the paper, and is against, this new system titled Level of Service Inventory, which might or would cause some of these AFHs to possibly close down as due to the proposed rate increases or rate cuts, whichever case may be, because I've become like part of their Petrie family there, and man, if I could be adopted by him, I would do it in a minute.
Thank you so much.
I just wanted to comment that here that our home, which was formerly known as the Terry Lee Foster Care Home, has now been officially and affectionately renamed the Birdhouse.
The Birdhouse.
Because that's what it looks like from the outside, is a full-size birdhouse. And also I make good use of the Chariot bus system, as I also do volunteer work twice a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, as at the Marion Polk Food Share.
That's great.
And if I was evicted, put out because of this changes, I don't think I could do that as easy as I easy as I can do now. And I just want to add that the closest bus stop is only about 1.5 to 2 blocks from the home, from the birdhouse, and you couldn't ask for a more desirable place.
Well, thank you so much. You've spoken very well. You should come back. You're really good at this. All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome,
and
man.
You've got lots of applause behind you. All the hands are in the air. All right. So next up, I'm just going to go down the list and pull you up in panels of three.
Do family members go with clients, or is there a separate time for family?
Family members... Sure. Are there family members that are not also paid providers in the room? Yes, you? Yeah, come on up. Come on up.
Welcome. We have 2 minutes or more.
We've got two long pages and have to get back to the floor. So closer to 2 minutes is better than closer to 20.
Okay, my name is Laura, L-O-R-A, Walker, and I have submitted written testimony. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
I am a sister of a mentally ill person. I am a 35-year-plus State of Oregon staff who provided services to mentally ill clientele 28 years at the Oregon State Hospital. I submitted written testimony. It has more detail than what I can say here. My sister was, I am the second oldest of 7 girls. My sister is the youngest. She was very sick and resistive to treatment for many years. A few years ago, I became her legal guardian. A year and a half ago, she became a patient at the Salem Psych Unit for approximately a month, stabilizing, and then went to a Terry Lee home here in Salem for several months, stabilizing more. She is a success story and has now been in her own apartment for a year. I fully support reinstating funding for group homes that provide services for mentally ill clients. I am well aware of what gets people to the Oregon State Hospital. I have heard and known firsthand for years how broken the community mental health system is, as well as the state part of the whole system. These group homes provide so much care and treatment. Please support funding for these people at a cost of $2,000 to $5,000 a month, rather than wait for a crime and pay $23,000 to $30,000 or more at the state hospital. The state hospital just in this past few days has received 12 chairs that cost over $13,000. Four of them that I know of are leather. The state of Oregon certainly has the money to provide the most basic care for the most vulnerable in our community before they become dangerous and or possibly lose their lives, become homeless, have things happen on the street. So some of this funding for the state really needs to go to the first frontline treatment. Thanks.
Thank you very much. All right, so next I'm just going to start going down the list. Lynn Ashcroft, Mike Murdoch, and Terry Petrie, please. And if I pronounce names wrong, I hope that you will forgive me.
My name is Lynn Ashcroft. Mr. Murdoch has had a little bit of an anxiety attack, and he has left me what he was going to say. But I also have a statement that I'd like to make. Frankly, the first part of the statement would be that I think the last four voices that you've heard are probably all the voices you really need to hear today. They're pretty moving. I'm an attorney, and I represent some adult foster care providers. And I'm not going to speak to the practical effects of what's going on, but I'd like to offer some observations as to what's brought us here today and put these providers in this situation. Oregon Revised Statute 443733 was enacted in about 2008 by the legislature. It was passed into law, and the governor signed the bill. That statute provides a mandated definition of all adult foster care providers in Oregon as being public employees. It's a statutory illusion. It gives them no rights, but identifies them as that. It also provides that there will be one bargaining unit. That bargaining unit would be the exclusive unit and would represent all adult foster care providers who are contracting with the state. SEIU became that exclusive bargaining unit pursuant to the governor signing an executive order in 2008-2009, and since that time SEIU has been the exclusive bargaining unit that the state of Oregon has dealt with. The problem with the circumstances that we find ourselves in today is that even though SEIU is identified as the exclusive bargaining unit and they are the only bargaining unit the state will negotiate with, SEIU does not and will not and has not represented my clients or most of the people in this room here today. And they have told me that. They've told the providers that. And so these people have no voice. What happens is that there are trade-offs that are made in these negotiations. There are bargains that are made. And as the exclusive bargaining unit for contract negotiations, if you don't have representation there, your voice isn't heard. A representative of SEIU has stated that any provider whose interests are not represented by the union, we're free to negotiate with the state. The state won't negotiate with these folks. They will only negotiate with the union. So you have the union saying, we don't represent you. We have the state saying, we won't talk to you. And these people have no remedy. I've had contact with some 15 separate providers who serve approximately 120 adult foster care clients. Without exception, they have told me the following. Neither the state of Oregon nor SEIU provided any advance notice of an intent to adopt a contract that provided for reduction in compensation. They had no knowledge of this until after the fact. Even though they were not members of the union, SEI representatives still informed them that SEIU was the exclusive bargaining unit and would represent their interests. These people relied upon that representation from SEIU. These folks are bound by the contract that the state of Oregon and SEIU enters into. The representatives of the state of Oregon have consistently refused to provide any contract information to these providers and have universally referred them to the union in regard to such inquiries. Upon contacting the union, these folks are told that because they are not union members, they have no standing, they don't have any right to the any information that the union possesses, and the union does not disclose the information to them. SEIU representatives have, however, advised these people that SEIU represents their interests, and in the case of my client, one of my clients said, you will reap the benefits. One of the people actually specifically called SEIU and asked them about the contract, and they were just stonewalled. They were told that you will be seeing what it is, and basically that was the end of it. These providers had no voice, no notice, no opportunity to be heard during the negotiation phase and ratification of the current contract. Their rights and interests were not protected or even considered, and certain administrative rules were changed, not because there was a practical need for them, but in order to facilitate and support the contract terms and provisions. There was no feasibility or impact study, no inquiry into the effect on the clients, and no plan of what to do with these clients when these reductions went into effect and the ultimate and inevitable closures occurred. Ask the union why it is that virtually without exception, the affected providers are not union members. Ask the union if they represented the interests of these providers in the contract negotiations and why they did not give prior notice to any of these folks. Ask the state if they will negotiate with or even discuss contract provision with these providers. The answer to that will be no. The union is the exclusive bargaining unit. And who benefits? Not these folks, and not the residents. The fundamental principle of our legal system is the right to notice and the opportunity to have your interests be heard, to have a voice. SEIU by law is supposed to be the voice of these folks, but the SEIU has not represented their interests. They have no representation, no voice, and no remedy. That is simply not fair or right in our system of law and justice, and that was not the intent of the law when it was enacted. It is the effect that the union and the state has put upon this statute.
And let me ask a clarifying question. My understanding is that a foster care provider that lives in the home and provides care to the individuals directly is represented by the union.
That's what the union tells us.
Correct. And so, for instance, in other systems like the DD system, you'll have a provider community that is not represented by the union because they are the providers, the employers, the business owners. So is it possible that there is a mismatch in the way that the adult foster home system is set up for mental health care, where we have people identified as foster care providers with I was surprised when I read these things to learn that a foster care provider could have 5 or 6 homes and 20
yes.
different individuals. I think of a foster provider as someone that opens the home that they already own, that they already live in to care for others that come in. So And that's who I understand SEIU to support, are those foster providers that bring people into their family homes.
Well, I don't know that I would call them necessarily family home, but a home in which they reside. But I think the answer to your question is yes, that's correct. That's what SEIU's position is. The statute, though, if you want to say this, is defective from the standpoint of it doesn't differentiate or delineate that issue.
And I think that's my question. I'm wondering if we need to look at the statute to get back to either clearly delineating where there's a provider organization that's basically
right.
a business that purchases multiple homes and hires employees, as opposed to what we've always thought of as adult foster care in our other service settings, where the foster provider only has as many people as they can have in their own home. They are the primary care provider for the person, not shift staff.
If that is the structure that the state wants to have, then yes, the statute needs to be revisited. But that's not the structure the state has had. And by state, I mean what's been happening. There have always been providers that didn't reside in the homes. There were at the time that this statute was enacted, and there have been since then. The flaw that I see in this is not only that issue, but SEIU telling these folks, we represent your interests in contract negotiations. They don't, and they haven't. And so when you go to the state of Oregon, and the state of Oregon says, we don't negotiate with you, these folks have no remedy. And that's the issue that I see.
Well, I'm going to move on to the next person. It sounds like an interesting conversation for another day, but we
yep.
should probably go Mr. back
Murdoch
to the
rights. Mr. Murdoch has asked me to read his statement.
You know, since he's not here, we can add right. that into the record,
okay.
but we've got so many people to go
that's
through.
Fine.
Thank you.
I will tender it.
I think mine will be a little shorter.
Okay.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to be heard today. For the record, my name is Terry Petrie. I'm a mental health adult foster care provider. I have 2 homes that are located here in Marion County with a capacity of 10 residents. I'm here today to oppose the new rates to providers, With the new rates, I will not be able to keep my two homes licensed through addictions and mental health. I will not be able to continue to provide the quality care that I have been. My residents have been stable and they sustain in the lowest. I'm sorry.
You're doing
I'm nervous.
Great. You're doing really great.
Okay. My residents have been able to sustain in a lower level of placement in the less restrictive setting and also the lowest cost for placement. November 7th, I received an email update from the Oregon Health Authority of the rate changes. I cannot help myself but to reach out to my fellow providers because I knew right away this wasn't going to work for our residents or our homes. For each provider that I talked to outside of the county, 98% of the providers stated to me they have not even heard of the rate change yet. I was actually the one who sent it to them. Of the 85% of the providers that I talked to has stated to me they are not going to be able to sustain their homes either. February 13th, we had a provider meeting here in Marin County. And at this meeting, we had several different providers from several different counties within the state join us. At a raise of hands of who could not keep their homes open, I seen the hands of 100 residents that are going to possibly be displaced. And we only had so many providers there, a lot less than we see here today. I oppose the new rates, and I ask for people to just look into seeing what's going on. Find us a solution, please, because I want to keep my homes.
Right. Thank you so much for coming. I appreciate it. And can you give to Maria? And that will get uploaded into OLIS, and we'll all be able to see it. Thank you. So next, Rhonda Schoenberg, April Gunter, and Scott Weiland.
Oh, it's you again.
Welcome.
Hi. I'll just go. My name is Rhonda Schoenborn. I'm with Clackamas County, and I have 15 clients and 3 homes.
So when you said you're from Clackamas County, but you don't work for Clackamas
County.
Correct.
Okay, I have homes in Clackamas County.
All right. Thank you.
And when you're asking the gentleman previously about adult foster homes and people that live in the homes versus businesses, I have been doing this for 16 years. I raised my family in the homes, and now I have the other two homes that my daughter and son also helps with. So even though I don't live in the home now, it's been in a family business for 16 years. So I'm going to give you a little bit of statistics. 1 in 5 adults experience mental health illness in a given year. And I bet you guys all know somebody that has a mental health issue. 1 in 5. 26% of the homeless adults staying in shelters live with a mental illness, and an estimated 46 with severe mental illness and substance use disorder, and it will be much higher if these homes close. That's 46% in shelters. And this pay that we're now receiving is what I was getting paid less when I started in 2001. Paid less. That's a 60% pay cut. These are our residents' homes, and the degree and scope of services we provide the adult foster care providers afford them in many cases maximum independence because they could go out in the community and do as varied things as they can because they have the medications and the critical elements provided by myself and by my staff and other adult foster homes, and they are not decomping. They are at their best. There's this new push for a key to every door for some of our folks, and the reality is the key to every door is not possible for some of our folks. They have the key to our door. We celebrate birthdays, holidays, skill build. We become their family when a lot of these folks have no family that come to see them or support them. When one of our folks is struggling, they have the support of staff and housemates. We celebrate their victories, and we help them when they're decomping. We are saving the state thousands of dollars by us being on the front lines with our folks and seeing the decomp early and getting the help and resources for them. The example of not eating nutritious meals, taking their medications, personal hygiene, the loss of intentional family is going to be devastating. We all need family support. Moving them to more independent living, or if they move wherever from the adult foster homes, from my experience, if these folks don't have the resources, family, and friends, they decomp, and at times they're more symptomatic and will never reach that baseline where they started when they moved out. These cuts are way too deep. We need the ability as providers to be able to provide the best service and support with the cuts. As they are currently, we cannot do this. In many cases, providers, including myself, will have to close homes. And these homes, in reality, really are not our homes. They're homes of our honored citizens that we serve. I have 15 clients. They are thriving in our homes. And we have lost staff currently to help support our folks because we cannot afford to pay them reasonable rates. And I would like to bring this up. The neglect rule, BAII, is defined in the Adult Protective Service for Mental Health states. Failure creating a risk of serious harm or results in physical harm, significant emotional harm, or unreasonable discomfort or serious loss of personal dignity. All of these people are residents who are going to have to be moved out of their home due to these severe budget cuts, are going to feel the significant emotional distress and harm. And that is under the Protective Service of Mental Health. That's OAR ruling. These are human beings. These are their homes. One in five people have mental health issues. And I believe that every one of us knows somebody that has a mental health issue, and this will affect them. So thank you. And if you have any questions for me.
Thank you. We'll go through the panel and we'll have people follow up after just so we can get through everyone.
Perfect.
That's here. Thank you.
My name is April Gunter and I'm a provider. I do not believe that we are saying anything that you guys don't already know. I think the bottom line is funding, and I think that OHA has created this and facilitated with SEIU this deficit that we are feeling. I think that you guys know the impact. You guys aren't ignorant. I mean, you know that these people will be out on the streets. The bottom line is we have to find a resolution for it. Resolution meaning you guys have to find the money somewhere to fund us, because that is exactly the words OHA said. Until we get funding, you will no longer be getting the pay. So that's got to be remedied. The outcomes are our home shutting down. The people will be out on the streets. Do you want that in your community? I mean, your daughter, people getting, you know, shot by police officers, you see that in the news, the mentally ill going to Taco Bell, you know, trying to rob them with a rubber gun. These are our clients. We're not talking acutely mentally ill clients. We are talking people who have been in our homes for 14 plus years. They are severely, persistently mentally ill clients. We're not talking about, okay, this person's sick for 6 months. This 1915i program in the LSI program, they do not fit our clients at all. This is a program that was facilitated to get a waiver program for money without taking into account our clients. You're talking about ADLs versus behavioral mental health. It just doesn't fit. You're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole that doesn't work. I don't think I can say anything that's going to make a change unless the budget changes and we get money. It does say in the union contract that they have already implemented the cuts, but the contract has not been ratified. But in that contract, it does state that there is an opportunity for exceptional rates. We have been emailing OHA asking for those exceptional rates, and we immediately get shut down and say, we have no money. And until February 24th, and that was my last email, until February 24th, and we see what happens, there's no talking to you. I will not discuss it with you. Period.
Thank you very much.
So I'm hoping out of all of this, I mean, the outcome has to be budgetary. if the money's there, it's got to come from somewhere else. We shouldn't be with SPD and under the same umbrella as, you know, area agency. We are addictions and mental health programs. We need to be funded through addictions and mental health and get some of that money. We're licensed through addictions and mental health. We are not licensed through SPD.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you.
And you're getting applause in the background.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. My name is Scott Weiland. My wife and I are providers at Golden Eagle in Bend, Oregon. We've been doing this close to 15 years. We started off with just me and my wife, and after a couple years, that we found an excellent resident manager who's been with us for about 10 years, who does the evening and weekend shift. We just cut his pay by $6,000-$7,000 because of the cuts, because it is for us about a 60% cut, and it's going to be very difficult with the quad, because these are rates from 3, 4, 5 years ago. I don't have the exact numbers. My accountant did do some cost-benefit ratios from the pay we've been getting the last couple years to what's happening now. We service 5 residents. Our beds are usually full. We're not a lockdown facility. Obviously, we have somebody there 24 hours a day. The residents we serve are usually level 5 on the LOCUS scores, which I realize we're not. We're using LSI scores, which is what changed all this. And from what I understood, it's because the state claims they were losing $2 million a month since they initiated this. Probably there's a little more to it than that, but I don't know. And that's what our accountant told us. It's going to be tough for us to keep the facility open. This is something my wife and I spent years fixing this house up. And with the little extra money we've gotten the last couple years, we put a lot of it back into the house. We just put all new windows in, a heat pump system, painted the house. We have always worked directly with the county to fill our beds. We have serviced probably 60, 70 residents over the last. Fortunately, there's a. Some of the same ones have been placed in our homes on multiple occasions over the years. As an example, a young person came to us from the hospital for 6 months in 2002 when the county asked if they would have them back later in 2004. Then they were with us for only 2 months to get transitioned back into the community. And to our knowledge, they still are living in the community. We used to be first stop out of the state hospital and last before independent living. When we started, most of our clients came from Pendleton, a couple from Salem, some more of the extreme cases. And we did do PSRB on and off for many years because we were the only home that were able to offer that service for the county for men and for women. In the last few years, obviously, things have changed, and PSRB is being handled by independent homes exclusively for PSRB, not mixing the AMH in there. Most of our residents do have dual diagnosis with severe mental illness, most of which are on the highest levels of medications that can be, according to the doctor. With the raise, we started doing more transportation. I bought a new van. We try to get our residents out into the community. That's a big push that's been going on for a couple years nationally and statewide to try to incorporate our folks into the community so that they're not hidden somewhere. And that's been a big, big push that we've been very much supportive of and a part of. Services we provide are usually full assistance with medications, assistance to set up their medical appointments, rides, for blood draws, medications. We have done behavioral and addiction contracts set up through our caseworker, through the county, Deschutes County, and ourselves, where we closely work with residents that are typical problems that a lot of these residents have, usually a lack of resources and funding and money. And our residents do often require full or partial assistance with cooking, cleaning, laundry. Yes, the ADLs are the main thing of level one homes, but we feel we've always done way more. We feel like we are an extension of the family. We have a resident who hasn't had any contact with any family members for 20 years. And he gets emotional around the holidays, and, you know, and then like probably most of us, we have the, it's your home, you know, put the Christmas decorations up unless somebody's offended. And, but these cuts, and, you know, I was talking with folks in Salem who were instrumental in getting these raises, and when I called to thank him for that, he said, well, listen, Scott, we're afraid we're losing a lot of good providers. We just wanted to make sure the providers are getting what they were worth, and we just wanted to be on par with the private sector.
Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. And you're getting applause from your friends in the background. I like this setup. All right. Next, we have Randy Cammy and Hunter Jones. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're all coordinated.
Planned it
like
out.
Like a team.
All right. So, Chair Gelsler and members of the committee, I'm Hunter Jones, and I work as direct care at our home, and we work for the Linn County Mental Health Services. I was raised on these floors since I was just a little guy running around my diapers, pretty much. I've been living with these folks for my whole life, and it's honestly, it kind of makes me sick to see this happening right now. But our program's had great success with helping people in rough situations. One example that stands out to me was a gentleman that I've grown up with since I was 10 years old. He came to us in complete crisis. He was lost, and he was hurting. At certain points, he went to the hospital once, and he came back. And because we're a home, we accept everyone in. And we took him back with open arms. And we use lately we've been using CPS, and we've built a very positive relationship with him. And I have the privilege to work with him almost every weekend now, and he's come a long way. He's a great guy. And in fact, we have a neighborhood store that's literally next door, and he goes in there every so often, and they've told us, they've gone out of their way to tell us, like our program, that he's a great guy and he's one of the most courteous people they've had come through. And this is huge, because I remember him coming in first week and he was punching holes in the wall, and he was controlled by his disability. And it's just, we change people, you know, like people that are hurting and people that are struggling in life, they come to us, and, you know, we do our best. We give them somewhere safe, we give them compassion, and we give them hope. And I think that's what's most important about all this, and we can't just throw this away. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Give him a minute, because if he cries, I cry. It just happens.
You're getting applause in the background.
Okay, so I have to read it off of a letter because I'm shaken. Chair Gessler and members of the committee, my name is Cammie Jones, and I am a foster care provider for our home foster care in Linn County. I know that everybody is going to come up here talking to you about empirical data, statistics, and they're going to have a ton of information that's going to be relative and valid to this whole thing. And it's all very meaningful, and it's all very important. I'm going to come to you with regarding the impact in a different way, not the budget, not loss for providers, not loss for services. I'm going to talk about the loss of hope, because we are the voice of a voiceless demographic. We are a place of belonging for those that struggle to find acceptance.
You're doing great.
We are the unconditional understanding for those that suffer mental illness on their worst days. We are the celebration for when they celebrate their best days. We are a safe haven for those misunderstood by those only who see the stigmatization of mental illness. We are belonging. We are hope. We are a home. And everybody deserves home.
Thank you very much. And you're getting applause in the background.
Chair Gelsler, members of the committee, my name is Randy Jones, and I represent our home, adult foster care. I'm the only licensed mental health home in Linn County, and I serve five people struggling with severe and persistent mental illness, and I do live in my home. I wish to begin by informing you today that Oregon has received a mental health bailout, and we now find that the relief has not been utilized according to the federal regulations, and this has affected all of our adult foster cares. Please see my attachment, the waiver. The changes are made without notice or consent, and therefore without any input from those that provide or receive these services. In this case, the state actually failed to notify local mental health agencies of the changes as well. The changes are so drastic that many will lose their services, including their current residents. This has happened despite the Federal Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, later expanded by the Affordable Care Act of 2010. This act created a Medicare waiver in 1915 that includes several sub-programs, namely the 1915I. Wherein the federal government allotted extra funding to help reduce the state's deficits and ensure that services were expanded, not lost. The waiver instructed each state to choose a specific population of people receiving mental health services, and the 1915I waiver will pay a portion of each of their service costs. Oregon did an excellent job in selecting the population and decided that everyone that is diagnosed with a mental illness may qualify. Part of that waiver mandated that the service rates be set by the state and must meet certain criteria. Oregon set the 1915I for people living independently at $27.50 an hour and allotted up to 3 hours a day, or roughly $25.50 a month. Additionally, the waiver mandated that every person from the population that Oregon chose was to receive 1915I. This includes people living in residential, such as adult foster homes. Though the spirit of the waiver is clearly intended to prevent the loss of services, the waiver failed to include a language that prevented the state from collecting the waiver and cutting the same services. Oregon took it a little further and decided that most foster care service payments would fall within the $2,200 a month. Though the people living in foster care are not as independent and require more supports, thus foster care is 24 hours a day. It is hard to justify this, and under the waiver, it is actually a requirement to explain why the service payments differ from model to model. It is now appears that OHS may actually be collecting up to $750 for each foster care placement in Oregon. OHS decided that it could give foster providers that would give foster providers 1915I payments and forego paying the rest of the service payments. For me, this represents a 60% cut in pay. And again, it would appear that OHA is actually making money by having already set the 1915 waiver at $25.50 a month and paying me $2,200 a month. Part of the reasoning that OHA used is this misguided belief that the licensed mental health foster care providers do not provide mental health services. Somehow we ensure that the cooking, cleaning, and medications are completed without neither interacting nor problem solving. I can state and have provided examples of mental health services that I am required to provide. A good deal of resources are spent on extra staff and training in order to provide supervision and skilled interactions at a level that I actually have a recovery rate. I now know the cure for the mentally disabled, and I can prove it. The recent budget cuts prevents its application, and the people that I help to leave services will remain in state-funded care because of it. I am addressing you today not to inform you the need for service for the mentally ill in Oregon, not to talk about the impacts of recent budget cuts, nor the effects on vulnerable people, though it has jeopardized the well-being of hundreds. My fellow providers have and will do a better job of articulating that. Rather, I am wishing to present a solution that will help negate the impact of adult foster care being restricted from providing mental health supports, and will ease some of the expenses of having people with less needs in a skilled training environment. Please explore this issue. I know that if all stakeholders can collaborate to not only solve the budget woes, but to also craft a sensible and effective mental health recovery system. We need only to ensure that supports are available at all levels of care, such as legislating that collaborative problem solving is mandatory for skilled supports, and relicensing all foster homes as either a CPS foster home or an ADL foster home. Wherein mental health support could be provided in the CPS home and an ADL foster home with no requirements for skilled problem solving, and thus with appropriate budgets for both. I have proven that adult foster care is viable, effective, and in the long run, extremely less expensive than any other environment or model of care. I can demonstrate through empirical case study in Linn County and elsewhere that I have saved the state well over $120,000 with just one case recently. And this is not an unusual circumstance. In fact, I would argue that this is the least of some of the cases I have saved resources on. I have been party to a foster care saving over $2 million on one person. And again, I can prove it. I have provided services for those living with mental disabilities, including the cognitively deficient, for over 22 years. And I've had the opportunity to provide those services in many different settings, from institutions to personal homes. In all of those years and out of all those programs and models of support, adult foster care utilizing collaborative problem solving as the model of care is the only time I have seen people actually become recovered. I would bet that I have saved the state more money than I have earned during my 22 years of service to those living with severe challenges. I do feel that the previous service payments were fair, and I do agree that not all clients require full foster care services. This leads me to suggest, again, that the legislators redefine foster care and create levels of care. This way we can offer ADLs only with no skilled problem solving or extra supervision, or we can provide a recovery environment, whereas skilled supports are used in an effort to assist the person in becoming recovered. I know this, no matter the license, no matter the model, no matter the skill of the supports, that without a safe, trusting relationship with those providing the supports, recovery is not possible. And that's as per Harvard, www.thinkkids.org. No amount of money will buy trust, but money pays for extra staff so I can spend time with each person I serve developing a relationship. And money buys training and collaborative problem solving so my interactions are skilled and meaningful in a way that maximizes each person's chance at recovering. And again, I now have a recovery rate. In fact, I can evidence that spending extra money now helps to solve lifelong challenges of living and lessens the impacts on other services such as jails and emergency responders. Without solving these problems, they continue to worsen, causing impacts on 911, jail, and psych units for the rest of the person's life. I have seen some of the same issues go unsolved for over 20 years prior to using CPS, costing way more money and resources. For example, I have worked with a person that required skilled supports, mostly from the state hospital, at $15,000 a month.
And Mr. Jones, I'm unfortunately going to have to ask you to summarize a little. We just have so many people still.
Sure. I've cut through the chase for you. In short, I believe that I know a better way. I believe that we can make this crisis into an opportunity to evolve the way people receive mental health supports and craft a cost-effective, impact-reducing programs that actually have rates of recovery. And with only a few exceptions, this is unheard of in Oregon, or in the nation for that matter. So please provide the supports that are so desperately needed while ensuring that those providing the supports are also equally supported. Thank you.
Thank you all very, very much. Thanks for coming. You're getting applause in the back, and I really appreciate hearing you talk about collaborative problem solving.
Thank you.
Very exciting. So we have a lot more panels, and I know that everyone here is probably interested in the presentation from the Oregon Health Authority after all of these. So I'd like to start limiting people. If you could try to keep your comments within about 3 minutes, then we can make sure everyone that's come gets a chance to speak and we get a chance to have a response from the Health Authority about the budget. So next up we have Dana Gibson, Judy Humphrey, and Karen Pierce. But if you didn't mean to sign up, that's fine. You didn't. Okay, then let's could Patricia McCall, did you mean to sign up? Why don't you come on up too? And that's Judy Humphrey that did not mean to sign up, right? Okay, great. Thank you. Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelsler, members of the committee. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Dana Gibson, and I own Deer Run Adult Foster Care Home here in Salem. I have 25 years experience in adult foster care. I have worked with developmentally disabled seniors and mental health. Before, I've heard a couple of terms come up and suggestions on things. One of the things that struck me with Randy's testimony, I believe CPS is a great model, but I believe still there's going to be a model of adult foster care where people are at their best and highest and will need additional supports in addition to ADLs, activities of daily living. I have two individuals in my home that are, according to their mental health assessments over the last 6 and 3 years, respectively, cannot live independently and require interventions on a daily basis. It's taken a long time to develop the relationship with them, and I won't say that they can't get further, but we have somewhat of an aging community as well. Some of them may not get to independent living. We also have some younger people coming into the system. Years ago, we heard of Aim High, and people were getting stepped down from higher levels of care. We were told by our case managers and our county licensors that we were going to see tougher and tougher cases. But we were at the perfect place because adult foster care was in the middle, and we shouldn't be concerned. Well, that was about 6 years ago or so, and I was being paid more than I am today. I employ my children who, like Hunter, were raised in an adult foster care home. These people are their family. I have one individual in my care who I've known for 27 years. That's not a relationship that can be swept under the rug. I believe that the LSI score, when that came into effect, it did not take into consideration behaviors. It's been suggested that we don't provide mental health services. I would like to ask you how a person in my care with a plan of care and dosing instructions from a prescriber, when they are in crisis, how I'm making a determination as to whether or not this individual requires that PRN or what the next step to help intervene with this crisis situation, how I'm not providing mental health services. If we were not intended to provide mental health services, why are we licensed differently than every other adult foster care in the state? Why then are we, we've been providing, it was perhaps not the intention of the rules and how they were written, but I think that it didn't consider that we would in fact become higher skilled on a daily basis. I have to be able to recognize psychosis versus physical ailments such as a urinary tract infection, which can cause my residents to go into, you know, emergency rooms and other types of care. So, you know, I would ask that you consider that where we were at before with locus rates, I had one rate that went, I took a big jump. It went from about $2,650 to a little over $4,000. It was a big jump. My other individual was already at that rate and stepped up a couple hundred dollars. Those rates have been cut significantly. My home will close. You will displace three individuals who are in care as well as four other individuals. And I just ask that we try and find a solution. I think that there is one out there, albeit I don't know exactly what it is at this point because...
thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I'm not a provider. I'm an employee of the Murdoch.
And can you start with your name?
My name is Patty McCall, and I've been an employee of Mike and Jennifer Murdoch for approximately 6 years. There seems to be some misconception about the care provided in adult foster homes. Adult foster care provides a stable environment for people with mental illnesses. It is also my home. If the homes close, I will be without a paycheck and health insurance, as Mike Murdoch is one of the few, if not the only, provider that provides health insurance to his employees. I have had residents with mild to severe mental and physical illnesses, but the main thing that they all have in common is that they need a home where they feel safe. The things that most people take for granted are provided in our homes. We ensure medical care, dispense all of their medications, and set up transportation to their appointments. Healthy meals are provided. Their birthdays, as well as all other holidays, are celebrated, and for some, it's been their first birthday party. Being in a stable environment provides them the support system necessary and crucial to keep them out of the court system, the hospitals, and to maintain sobriety for those with addictions. Their caseworkers are able to give better support to their clients because they are stable and in one location. It is difficult to provide services to those that are homeless. The homeless are generally off their medication and commit petty crimes such as loitering, trespassing, theft, and assaults. All of these crimes are directly related to the fact that their basic needs are not being met. The medication is imperative to those basic needs as it helps people with mental illnesses to make better decisions required to lead as healthy and as normal of a life as possible. Another point I would like to make that the current scoring system that the providers pay is based on overlooks the fact that some of the clients cannot read or write, which adds another level of care. Two of my residents cannot read or write, and I have to take care of their mail and accompany them to the doctor so that I can fill out their paperwork. One of them is also developmentally challenged, so I have to be his advocate. What would happen to them if we closed? There are certain residents that can't ever take care of themselves. They do not require a higher level of care because they are stable and other institutions are a lot more expensive. Adult foster care provides an invaluable service to our community, and to allow them to close would be a travesty. These are human beings with a need. Mental illness is a cruel and merciless disease, and without a home where they are treated with dignity, they will fall through the cracks and end up in jail or the hospitals, where once released will go on to commit the same bad behaviors and crimes over and over again. I have had residents such as this who have come into our homes and remained stable and off drugs and alcohol for years. We desperately need these homes. Please help us to help them.
Thank you very much.
Chair Gelsinger and committee, thank you very much for having me here today. My name is Karen Pierce, and I'm currently a Class 3 home for adult and senior services. I have three mental health residents in my home. I started doing mental health about a year and a half ago, and before all these cuts were determined, I was switching my house over to mental health services because it's something I liked. My mom was one of the first homes in the state of Oregon to open. I worked with my mom when my kids were younger, with the elderly, and then I spread my wings and went on to be management in facilities and a pharmacy tech and things like that. So I've seen a lot of variety of people. Now, when the mental health came to me, it became like a passion because there is a great need. There is a great need. The people that I have in my home now, one had spent 6 months extra in the state hospital because they didn't have a placement for him. They wanted him to be placed in a secure facility. They waited 6 months, could not find a secure facility that would take him because they didn't have any openings. So they finally found my home, and then they placed him. I have people that have lived on their own with mental health services wrapped around them. They have failed. We're doing drugs, alcohol, breaking crimes. They come into my facility. I walk them through the court system, get them off their probation or continue on with their probation. And I'm a little confused here today because I know that there will be a lot of homes closing if these cuts go forward. I've lived poor, so I'm not so concerned with the rates. I wear Walmart clothes. But what are the residents going to do? Because if they're already having a problem placing these people, spending 6 months, he spent 3 years in the state hospital. Now, if you're spending 6 months extra in the state hospital after they want to get rid of you and put you somewhere else, if they're already having troubles, what kind of troubles will they have in the future? So that's my main concern, is what are all of these, in my opinion, Marin County and Linn County and all the other counties, they don't have enough mental health homes. They have lots of adult foster care homes, but the elderly don't mix well with mental health. So you can't really place them amongst each other. It would be horrible. But that would be my main concern, is what would we do with these people? Because if they're already having a problem placing them, where are they going to place them if 50 homes close?
All right. Thank you so very much. Thank you all so much for coming. And you're getting your applause in the background. Next up, we have Sherry Jemison, Freddie Brown, and Lydia Mampert. So I have been bad at managing the time because I'm listening and I'm not looking at the clock. So I'm going to set the timer. This is not targeted at all of you. It is because I have done not a great job managing time. So I'm just going to let the clock help me. So please go ahead.
Hi, Chair Gelsler and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us to be heard today. For the record, I'm Sherry Jemison. I am an owner-operator and very nervous of Amazing Grace Care Homes. I operate four adult foster care homes in Marion County. Three of those are SPD, and one recently transitioned over from SPD to mental health. Within my four homes, I serve 9 severely mentally ill clients. I've been a provider since 2000. I have 25-plus years experience working with elderly, disabled, and severely mentally ill, as well as I serve as a professional fiduciary providing private case management services. In 2006, I was appointed by the Office of Senate President Peter Courtney to represent the adult foster care homes of Oregon on the Medicaid Long-Term Quality and Reimbursement Advisory Council. I served that for approximately a year. That being said, I'm going to keep this short. I have a lot of experience. I've worked in the field for a lot of years. Pretty much everybody's touched on everything. I feel you guys get the gist of what's happening and what needs to change. My big thing right now is I want to point out that in the five counties right now that are represented by our senior services office here, there, as of 2:20 today, there are only 71 vacancies in five counties in the SPD homes. This room represents 45 homes that will be affected that will close. That's 192 clients, just the providers you see in this room. That being said, there's going to be a huge issue if we close. There's no place for them to go if we're thinking SPD. If we're thinking we'll talk to other counties, they're represented. So that's my big concern, is what happens to these clients. I have SPD homes, and I will stop serving the mental health clients, and I'll continue with SPD. With SPD, they say, well, you're right, your rates are kind of the same. Yes, they are. However, here's the trick that you're not hearing. I have the flexibility as an SPD provider to take private pay clients. I can take mental health clients. I can take DD clients. I can take state pay clients through SPD. So I have more options of covering my expenses and sustaining and maintaining. So I just wanted to put that out there. I think that's it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And you're getting your applause in the background. I just don't want anybody to think that they are the one that didn't get the applause. Oops. Okay. Great. Thank
Hi
you.
Hi, I'm Lydia Mummert, and I have five residents in Peaceful Lighthouse. It's an adult foster home that we run. And there's a lot to say. I'll just try to keep it short. This pay cut has been very hard on us. There's a lot of things that in my home, I have older clients that need a lot of help with ADLs also. I have a guy who has two neuropathy bags from his kidneys draining into his bladder and then out the bags. We have to change the bandages. We have to try to wake up with him at night sometimes when he doesn't get up because it can blast. And they have a lot of high needs. They, they need help with showers. So it's almost like perhaps an APD home, but there's a lot of mental health needs that they also have. I've been taking them to their appointments because they need an advocate. They cannot understand what the doctor's saying. They don't, they make up stuff that's not true. And I never got, paid for that. And I was okay with that when the rates were higher. But now that the pay went down, I won't be able to really afford caregiving so that I can go to the appointments with them, and therefore also will it would cause burnout in my job to be able to be with them all the time without having that time to be, have a day off every so often. It's really tough. I also do the birthday parties myself, and I bought them really wonderful food, organic meat. And now I feel like I have to go down to like the flavored brands in order to, be able to make ends meet. And I believe that they deserve to be in a home-like environment. I've seen great improvements. In fact, anyone will tell you that the residents that are in mental institutes, they don't do as well as clients in an adult foster home. They find stability, they find trust, they find love, compassion, and they need that. I mean, I see the improvements in the people that I've worked with, and it's amazing where they came from and how much anger and mistrust they had and hurt, and now they're coming around to feeling normal and, having stability. There's an incident where the state hospital got shut down here many years ago, and we had a lot of problems where people went out and they committed crime, suicide out here in Salem. And it's like, I worry about that, I worry about what's going to happen with all the population that's going to be running around on the streets without any care, without anyone to supervise them. They're a vulnerable population, and I think that we really need to work hard on making sure they're protected. It's not their fault they have these diseases, and we work really hard to provide everything we can and bless them, and we just appreciate your guys' time here today and trying to help us. It means a lot to us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good timing too.
How you doing? My name is Freddie Brown. I'd like to also thank you for this opportunity to speak before y'all today. Just a little bit about myself. I moved from Chicago here. I worked at Mental Health for 8 years in Chicago. I worked 7 years here at Conquest Mental Health Center. Now it's Life Work. And I have one home open in Monoma County there in Portland. And so, you know, the three guys I have, they have came a long way, and you know, looking at their history, they've never been in a stable home. Matter of fact, they're never been able to stay by themselves. Even their caseworkers have came to me and asked me, said, "What are you doing?" Well, because they're on their medication, they're in a stable home, stable place, and they're getting the needs that they need, daily needs meet, and so. When I came here, also, you know, I had a stack of papers when I came in, so I left them all back there. But it will affect my home tremendously with the three clients I do have, because even just getting here, you know, you have to hire caregivers. You have to, you know, if you're looking at mental illness and development disability, they tally so close. And really, all of it is work. So I'm really concerned even for the three guys that I have that are not able to meet their own needs. So I just like to thank you. I just want to say that.
All right. Well, thank you all so much. And you're getting your applause back there, too. All right. Next up we have, okay, I might not say these the right way. Sonora Shina, and then I translated it in my own handwriting. Is there a Sonora? Sandra Shanovich. I have the worst handwriting ever. And Krupara. Is someone here named Krupara? Concheria? No? Or anything that might start with a K that's waiting to get called? No? Okay. And Joseph Kincharla? Nope, might have left. All right. Don't feel lonely. Okay. And if you are in the overflow room listening, come on over. We'll be here when you get here. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sandra Shinovich. I own an adult foster home in Clackamas County. I have five residents. And everybody else has pretty much said, you know, what I was going to say. The only thing is, the people sitting in back of me, these people are just... they're crazy for doing what they do. I mean, on a daily basis, we are in our homes. If we live in our homes or if we don't. I don't live in my home. It works well. I have a resident manager. It's more like the mom and the dad, and, you know, you divide the power of the good guy, the bad guy. And you have to hire staff, and when you advertise for staff working in mental health, people are scared. They know there's physical aggression. They know there's manipulation. They know that they can be put in a position that can be taken wrong. You have to watch what you say to the residents. Watch what you do. They can strike out at you. They can become aggressive. Most of these people in this room, I don't probably think one person can say we've had to take people that everybody else has forgotten, has dropped through the cracks, that other people don't want. Because they're violent, they have histories, they don't take their meds. I don't think there's one person in this room that can say we haven't had to work diligently to strip these people from medications that people have piled on them to keep them silent or to keep them in a room because they aren't capable of living in bigger groups. The adult foster care was developed to bring a family and establish hope and commitment and responsibility and accountability that all adults want. Even children want accountability, responsibility, structure. We try to give that to our residents. And we work with populations that are dangerous, very dangerous. And I think people aren't seeing that. We have liability insurance that is outrageous. If you have home alone, your rates are skyrocket. You have workers' comp. You have insurance to provide. You know, these residents cannot survive without us. They are doing well because of us. I have not seen, I've had Woodlawn Care open since 99. I have not seen one tool from the state or the county, and excuse me if there's anybody that supports us from the county here, that truly reflects what we do on a day-to-day basis. I have not seen one measuring tool at all that accounts for the ADLs. I've been told I have a 74-year-old woman.
And you hit your 3 minutes. But you're very compelling.
There is a big picture you guys aren't looking at. Please look at it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And you're getting a lot of applause in the back. Welcome.
Senator Gelser and the board members, thank you for your time. My name is Joseph Concharla. I have a adult foster home in Astoria, Oregon. I had the privilege of being raised in it for 23 years. So from a child to being able to serve our community now, it has affected me very deeply. And I think a lot of people can relate to that because this job is something we choose to do every day. It's not something that we do from 9 to 5. It may be 2 o'clock in the morning. It may be at any time. I mean, just to be here for this meeting is so stressful to think about how are our people back at home. How are our caregivers, our residents, what's going on? Because we care about them so much. This is our life. We choose to do this, and we enjoy it. And if you don't, you can't survive in it. You know, this is, in the end, the people who suffer are our community. The people who are in our homes, if they have to be displaced, what do they do? These problems that are happening, it'll happen again if there isn't support for them. And we've seen people locally, I mean, just in our town with 10,000 people, you get very familiar with who's around in the city. I mean, what kind of things can happen. Safety is a big concern because not only for the people living in the home, the neighborhoods that we also live in, and to provide a safe, secure structure and environment for those people is so important because if they don't have that, then they're back to what they're doing, and it just puts everybody in danger. But we're the people who are there with them, and we're the ones who can make a difference. I don't really like to talk about myself and say, okay, this is what we're doing, but in reality, we can sit and talk about how can we fix this, how can we fix that, but the people in this room are people who are dedicated and putting their lives and wanting to really serve this community. And we're actively doing everything we can to help with that. I mean, I think everybody knows just nationwide that there's a big crisis with mental health needs, and it's only getting more and more. And we're the ones who want to continue doing what we do. And with these rate cuts, it makes it very, very difficult to do what we do. And I don't believe the rates that they're using and is a fair assessment of how much care we provide for the residents. And I think it needs to be relooked at. I don't have a solid solution, but what is done, the checks that we get just after. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And you're getting applause in the back behind you.
To the Honorable Chair and respectable committee members, I am Krupa Rao Concharla. I'm from Astoria. For the last 23 years, we are caring for the different needs of the individuals in our communities. my wife and my children, both of my children, they graduated from the college, and they want to come back and serve the people. And all the providers here, it is not a job, it is a passion. It is a passion and a love for the people, for the community. That is so important. They are no different. We treat them, they are one of us. That is so important for our, that is how we take care of our people, the residents. We provide the care and we advocate on the behalf of the residents. We take care of the safety and security of their where they live, and we give them so much hope every day, constantly remind them somebody is there, they can trust us. We avoid a crisis in their lives, in the homes, and in the communities. Avoid hospitalization and cut down the cost. One of the police officers, he came and told, I'm glad these individuals are here in a safe place so that they don't have to go and visit them so many times. We believe Oregon is a leader in providing the best quality care for its citizens. And for the most vulnerable citizens, we enjoy providing and meeting the needs of the residents in the state or in our counties. Other agencies did not provide a sufficient information about the changes in the rates to the providers. It is so important to communicate what things are going to happen, how we can handle our businesses. Though it is a small business, if we are taking up few residents and if we can't handle it, we lose the home, we lose the jobs, and it becomes so much chaos in our lives. And most important is the residents, about their lives. We want to serve the residents. We want to make a difference in their lives. That is the most important thing. I believe change is a good thing. A change is very good, but at this time, there were so many things that they did not consider. And I want to thank the for all the committee members for this opportunity. And one more thing is, want to include the providers in one way or the other for the communication. Thank you.
Thank you, and you're getting a lot of applause in the back.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much for taking time today to come and speak. I know that we have got to move on at this point. We will, Mr. Lane, we will try to get you up. I don't know where you are. We have a hard deadline at the end because we have to be back on the floor at 5 o'clock. I want to make sure that we hear the presentation that OHA has prepared at the request of the Senate President's office to talk about the rates and next steps. So we'll go through that, and then we'll loop back to pick up those that are left. But at 5 o'clock, when we have to be on the floor, there will be no committee that is left. So with that, Lynn Saxton, Oregon Health Authority. And I do know if you're panicking, we've got the three people from the county providers, Kim Decker, Carrie Maurer, and Rod Kalkers. So I checked with Michelle in the Senate President's office. We're going to do the health authority first so we can get this presentation out and then come back to the county folks and then any other providers that are left after that until we run out of time at 5.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today about this important issue. I want to introduce, I'm sorry, his name.
And will you introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm Lynn Saxton, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. I was concerned about introducing my colleague, Justin Hopkins, who is our Contracts and Compliance Director. I don't know if it's possible to dim the lights. Yeah. We're going to be doing some data. So
it just takes a second for them to go down.
Thank you. A number of issues have been raised by non-union represented providers. The issues that we have summarized from our conversations are first that rates are different for the Oregon Health Authority adult foster homes as opposed to the residential treatment facilities. Second, that the 2016 rates are not enough money. And third, that there has been poor communication by the Oregon Health Authority regarding new rate implementation. So today we'd just like to share some information with you. I will just say candidly and frankly that we can always improve on our communication, and part of what we're working on at the agency is using multi-tiered communication approaches so that we get to all users of all types of information.
Is it possible to put it in the presentation form so that the words are a little bigger so we can see them? Like if you click on the slideshow. Sorry.
Yeah.
This one.
Thank you.
Sorry, I really need to go back to see my eye doctor.
Me too.
I got applause.
Okay. Okay. So let's keep going. Do that one.
There you go.
So first, we just want to be clear on what is an Oregon Health Authority adult foster home. It is for people who've been diagnosed with a mental illness. An adult foster home is a licensed facility that provides home-based habilitation, which includes activities of daily living, and has a capacity up to 5 clients per home. And the graphic beneath that just shows the array of residential options in the behavioral health system in Oregon today. In accordance with ORS 443705 and OAR 309040, providers are required to obtain a state-issued license to operate to meet those standards, and that gives you the background. I won't read those out loud to you. When a provider application is approved by OHA, providers receive a letter notifying them of approval. The letter also directs the provider to resources, including the administrative rules, text and email updates, provider announcements, how to identify Oregon Health Plan members, and how to bill for covered services. Again, there are a series of rules, forms, and instructions, and I just want to point out that this is our website. As a courtesy, we communicate through our website any changes, training opportunities, or other announcements. And for clarity, the OARs do state that the Oregon Health Authority has the authority to change payments based on the criteria you see outlined under changes to payments. This next slide, I'm hoping you can see it largely. We wanted to show you the status of rates over time, and the left column is the actuals and the right columns in white are the budget. So as you can see, and the second, I just one more clarification, the years, the column of descending years, it says 2021. That's a typo. I apologize. It's 2012. So they are in sequential order. This includes the projected 2016 and 17 rates. It includes the projected minimum rate for 2016, which with a 5-client home, is, this is again the minimum, $135,000 per year, and at the maximum rate, $258,600 per year. The tax benefits are identified. There are no federal or state income taxes for providers who live and work in the home, and there are no property taxes. You can see the average payments to providers for calendar years 2000.
That's not right. There are property taxes. The rules are we can't talk from the audience. I'm sorry.
From 2011 to 2017, it's
and Lynn, can we just clarify the property tax? It's if the provider lives and works in the home.
No.
I'm asking Lynn.
It's the reverse, is that if the provider lives and works in the home, there are no property taxes. Did I reverse that? Okay. Yeah, no federal or state income taxes for providers who live and work in the home, and no property taxes. So, again, if people have documentation of something different, we'd love to see that. I want to highlight that you'll notice the payments doubled from 2013 to 2014, and also notice in the first column that the projected payments for 2016 show a $19,000 increase per provider from 2013. We talked a little bit earlier today about the level of care utilization system, which is the LOCUS system, and then the new level of service inventory, which is a person-centered needs assessment to measure the type and intensity of personal care or rehabilitation services needed by the individual in that setting. At the request of the Oregon Health Policy Board several years ago, the Oregon Health Authority began assessing how the Oregon Health Authority developed rate methodologies for adult foster home residents in addition to our other rate methodologies. At the time, we were only using the LOCUS tool, which is explained on this slide. The Policy Board was interested in ensuring patients were getting the right level of care and accordingly, providers were getting the right level of payment. In short, we want to incentivize stepping individuals down from higher levels of care if they are able. This is in alignment with our pending agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice to move people out of more restricted environments and into the community as quickly as possible. The Oregon Health Authority began to implement the LSI tool to assess the level of care required for the individual to be successful. Ultimately, this resulted in the 2016 rates in which a higher level of care required yields a higher payment. A lower level of care yields a lower payment. This slide documents the rollout of the LSI beginning on January 1st, 2015. And again, I'm not going to read it out loud to you. I think it's clear what was required and what we implemented. If we look at the background of the methodology of the rate changes, providers serving individuals with low assessed need may experience, as I just said, a reduced rate, while providers serving an individual with a high assessed need, such as many we heard here today, may receive an increased rate. We estimate that a rate increase between 3.5% and 20% will occur from the 2010 to 2012 rates, and on average, that's an 11% increase. We did have two years of abnormally high rates. I think, again, this first provider A looks like it's a typo, but if you look at provider B, C, and D, which are actual paid claims, it reflects the trend in revenue. It's important to underscore for all of us concerned about the needs of the behaviorally challenged in our community that without the right sizing of rates, the program can be in jeopardy as it's unsustainable financially. We need to get the resources to the people who need them.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Lynn, could you just clarify the abnormally high rates? What was that due to? Could you explain that?
The abnormally high rates were implemented due to a calculation error, as I understand it, by our agency. I'm being
remember that.
So
thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
And I don't recall when those were calculated.
Do you want me to add a little more?
Yeah.
So just to clarify, they were higher than they should have been.
Yes.
Through a administrative error.
Yes.
So Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Lynn already introduced me, but Justin Hopkins with the Oregon Health Authority. The rates for 2014-2015 were based on the LOCUS, which was a different tool, really, which is more appropriate for mapping to a setting than a level of service intensity. The LSI is a tool that's used for mapping to the intensity of services, and that's what the new rates are based on. So two different rate methodologies.
Okay. I want to talk about the communication to providers. This is a chronology of the communication to providers that began in November 2014. It is important to note that the people, there has been a transition in the structure of the Oregon Health Authority since this work has done with a current attendant adjustments in doing this analytical work. Again, we provided webinars, sequential webinars, notice via website, letters sent. We have an extensive mailing list and reminder notices as well. So we tried to use electronic and paper communication. The level of service determination This next slide is from our webinar that was held in December 2014, which clearly states that the LSI will allow, quote, the Oregon Health Authority to more accurately assign a rate of payment based on the type and level of service provided to AFH clients. This was 1 year in advance of any rate change. That said, we continue to look at ways to improve and enhance communication, including asking providers, contracted to providers, to designate to us in writing how they would like communication so that we can be clear that we're doing it specifically to how they would like to receive it. This is just a summary of the system. Currently, we have licensed adult foster care home beds of 664, and it gives you the other categories of as well. If adult foster home provider capacity is reduced due to a decrease in the number of providers willing to serve members with needs sufficient to justify a rate necessary to operate the home, OHA has capacity in both licensed and non-licensed levels of care to serve approximately an additional 230 members, with no limit on the number of members that can access home-based habilitation and personal care. Individuals in adult foster homes who have been assessed as not having service or support needs consistent with a higher rate could be transitioned to non-licensed home and community-based settings where they would receive Medicaid-funded habilitation or personal care services up to 24 hours a day as needed. To date, we've been made aware of two providers that have given notice to four residents. Those residents are being transitioned to a more appropriate level of care by the community mental health programs in Benton and Multnomah County. If additional notices are provided, Oregon Health Authority has contracts with a community-based health program in each county to provide case management and transition assistance to individuals displaced by failed AFH providers. Additionally, OHA has the ability to fund the same services an individual receives from an AFH provider in any licensed home or community-based setting the individual chooses to live. We look forward to continuing to collaborate with our partners in the service provision area. I'm happy to answer any questions, and we are happy to discuss any specific concerns or issues.
So, colleagues, I'll open you up for questions. We did just get a visit from the Senate President's office. They want us on the floor at 5 till 5, so we need to leave here at 10 till 5, so we've got about 5 minutes.
Just a quick clarification. I know that in the audience, I can tell by your body language that they had certain concerns about some of your slides, and I would, if per the chair, have them put it in. We don't have time, but have them put it in writing.
Yes.
These slides are available online, and so that you can really look at them, and then you can say this, we disagree with this, but put it in writing.
Yes, and give us examples, specific examples in your name and contact information.
Right.
Thank you, Senator Montes Anderson.
Yes, and if those go, you can email them directly to me, or I know many of you have been working with Michelle, so email those questions and comments. We will collect them. For your questions and comments to go into OLIS and to the record, that needs to be within 24 hours. But for us to read them, look into them, follow up on the questions and concerns, there's not a limit. But the sooner the better, so we can start working faster.
Madam Chair, just quickly, the issue of communications. So information was given to people who attended webinars. At what point did people get information in writing? Directly that their rates might go down?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, we can give you the specific dates that the letters were sent. The slides just refer to the letters being sent, but we're happy to submit the specific cycle of letters.
Great. And could you also include samples of the letters?
Yes, of course.
Great.
And Lynn, I'm noticing, again, body language in the background. Is it, when the letters went out, were they kind of a general letter saying your rates may change, or were there specific letters that went to providers saying your rate is now this, expect this percentage of reduction?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I think we have copies of the letter with us today. No. Yes. Okay. So that they were.
Is it the one that's in OLIS? There is a letter in OLIS. It says that Sarah Lochner It's not that letter?
It's not that letter. So okay. We will get
Can you get
the
us a
letters.
Copy of that?
Absolutely.
All right. And then we will put that in OLIS so that we can see that and you all can look at that and let us know that.
Great.
Thank you. Senator Dimbrough?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank
Representative
you.
Hack, did you have anything you wanted to add or ask?
For the sake of time, thank you, Madam right. Chair. I just want to say thanks for everybody for coming and for the presentation.
All right. Thank you so much. I was going to say Representative Saxton. Thank you so much.
You're an honorary representative.
All right. Thank you all so much for coming again. I apologize. We're at the end of the session, so this floor schedule is a little bit unpredictable. So we need to gavel out and head to the floor. The Senate President's office, we were asked to hear all of the providers first. So I'm sorry. We're an hour and 50 minutes, and we have to go to the floor. But please send the materials in writing. We will see them, and they will also go into OLIS, into that permanent record. I really appreciate the stories and the voices and the commitment that all of you provide to the individuals that you serve every day. This has been a very helpful meeting in terms of learning more about where some of the miscommunications and concerns are. We will, just because the hearing's over does not mean the discussion is over. We will be filling up with the health authority, and I will be watching my email, but just for efficiency's sake, continue to communicate directly with Michelle so everything is going to one place, and I think people know who Michelle is. She's been forwarding things to me, and I will be watching those and focused on those in the next couple weeks, and you can look for a response from me very soon. So with that, thank you all so much, and we are adjourned. And colleagues, please go.